You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we have made real and substantial progress, and we have seen new ideas surface. And that is why we are jointly extending these talks for 7 months.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, as if that was the plan all along. The postponement of a nuclear deal with Iran. I'll be joined by Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera to ask why it didn't happen and what happens next. We'll also look at the resignation of Chuck Hagel and the UK's latest anti-terror proposals, and we'll meet the mascots for Rio 2016. Later in the show, we'll check in with our woman in Brussels, meet the curator of the Heywood Gallery's new exhibition examining the online world, and review the week in the arts. That's all coming up right here on Midori House right now on Monocle 24. An action-packed hour ahead as always, but ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the world news.
Talks on Iran's nuclear program are being extended by 7 months after a deadline for a long-term deal passed without success. But all sides say there has been significant progress, justifying further negotiations. World powers want Iran to agree to curb uranium enrichment work in return for sanctions relief. But the US Secretary of State, John Kerry, says it's important to get the right deal, not just any deal.
Diplomacy is also difficult. These talks aren't going to suddenly get easier just because we extend them. They're tough, and they've been tough, and they're going to stay tough. If it were easier, then we'd have reached a final agreement months or even years ago.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is resigning. He's stepping down after less than 2 years in the job and 3 weeks after the Democrats suffered heavy losses in the U.S. midterm elections. Mr. Hagel will remain until a successor is in place. It's reported President Obama decided last week to replace his defense secretary, but at the White House had a lot of praise for Mr. Hagel.
Over nearly 2 years, Chuck has been an exemplary defense secretary, providing a steady hand as we modernized our strategy and budget to meet long-term threats while still responding to immediate challenges like ISIL and Ebola. Thanks to Chuck, our military is on a firmer footing, engaged in these missions and looking ahead to the future.
Ukraine's military says 3 soldiers have been killed in fighting in the east of the country in the last 24 hours. Officials in Kiev say around 150 have died since a ceasefire was imposed at the start of September. Earlier, Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, suggested he could order a referendum in the future on whether the country should join NATO, something Russia has said would be unacceptable. Meanwhile, Russia's finance minister says the falling price of oil, coupled with Western sanctions over the crisis in Ukraine, is costing the country up to $140 billion a year. Anton Silyanov was speaking at a conference in Moscow. Over the weekend, another Russian minister claimed that the sanctions were part of a Western plot to destabilize the Russian government. A Swiss museum is to accept hundreds of works of art bequeathed by the son of Adolf Hitler's art dealer. Cornelius Gerlitt had more than 1,200 works, including paintings by Picasso and Monet, and named the Bern Art Museum as the sole inheritor. The museum has said that it won't accept any works looted by the Nazis, and around 500 are likely to remain in Germany as a result. Christopher Marinello speaks for the Rosenberg family, which claims ownership of one painting by Matisse.
75 years after the war, we're still dealing with Nazi-looted artwork. And frankly, it's because, in my view, that the world has not dealt with the problem of Nazi-looted artwork in an adequate fashion. There are still cultural institutions, museums, and private collections that have Nazi-looted works in their collections.
A woman has been charged with attempted murder after a newborn baby was abandoned in a drain in Sydney. Police think the baby boy may have been there for up to 5 days. He's now being treated at a children's hospital in the city. The baby was discovered by 2 cyclists, David Otter and his daughter Hayley.
We actually thought it was, you know, a kitten or something like that. And it was only when we went down there and had a real good look at it that we could hear exactly what it was.
It was something that no one would ever want to see in their lifetime, so I'm glad that we got there and saved him. So that's the main thing, and that's all we want, is just to know that he's safe.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, de London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in Washington. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, we have Jeffrey Kaufman, journalist and commentator, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University here in London. Welcome both. We will begin tonight in Vienna, where, to the surprise of nobody at all, today's deadline for a settlement vis-a-vis Iran's nuclear program has passed with no agreement beyond one to extend the deadline for yet another 7 months. Jeffrey, I'll ask you first, is this just getting silly at this point?
Well, diplomacy often looks silly, but obviously it's underneath the silliness is a very serious issue, and that is, number one, containing Iran's nuclear ambition, and two, I think equally, well, perhaps almost equally important, is trying to bring Iran back into the fold with the West after 35 years of alienation that began with the overthrow of the Shah. That it is, it really matters now. The imbalance of power in the Arab world needs the counterbalance of Iran, the rise of ISIS, the power of the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, the disintegration of Syria. It would in many ways help the geopolitical stability of that region to have Iran as a player.
But there are, and I'll bring you in at this point, Oscar, there's a couple of mutually exclusive imperatives running there, isn't there? Because if Iran does persist down this course, that rapprochement with the West, which one assumes Iran quite wants as well, is never going to happen. At some point, Tehran does have to pick a team, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is very well reflected in the Iranian press. The two main conservative newspapers were still adamantly opposed to the deal, whereas the one more progressive, the one that follows the line of the government, seems to be to remain cautious, but quite optimistic and quite understanding of the fact that these talks, the success of these talks, are as important for Iran as they are for the West, as we just heard. One can say that things in Iran are also changing as the talks progress, and that's incredibly important. We do need Iran to come back to some sort of understanding with the West so that the imbalance of power in the Middle East is addressed.
Because just looking at this from afar, the thing I can't figure out, and the thing that I wonder whether anybody else has figured out, is it strikes me that one of two things is going on. Either Iran is trying to build a nuclear weapon and is just running out the clock until it gets to the point where they have one and therefore nobody can stop them, or they don't actually really want to build a nuclear weapon because they don't want a nuclear arms race in the Middle East any more than anyone else, but they don't want to climb down and make it look like they had to.
Right. And I think it's a second point.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that in fact, on both sides here, the issue is not the government's willingness. I think it's safe to say it is playing to the domestic conservative constituency, both in Tehran and in Washington. And that is what's holding it up, I think. I think it's the necessary posturing and brinksmanship that says, look, we really fought hard for this deal. We didn't just sign and walk away. And look, you know, we pushed those Americans, or look, we pushed those Iranians. You know, the problem is that Obama and Kerry now face a Republican Congress, and that Republican Congress has a rump that is really hostile to giving any concessions to Iran, and say that we're just going to get hoodwinked, so don't do this. And Obama has a real tough time delivering Congress. He can do this on his own, but ultimately Congress has to ratify it. The other side of it is that the conservative constituency in Iran has much the same kind of skepticism. And so these are really, as with so much of international diplomacy, it really is a reflection of domestic politics.
That being the case, if it is the case that Iran is trying to find a dignified way out of this, then does that not mean that the West, or at least, and it's not just the West, it's basically everybody but Iran, doesn't want Iran having a nuclear weapon. Does it actually make sense for everybody else just to walk away from this for 7 months, although obviously negotiations will continue, but to let the Iranians figure out for themselves how they're going to dig themselves out of this hole?
Well, I think the point that was made was very well made before. It is the case that in both countries we have conservative forces which are opposed to the deal. And as we know, in every single example of diplomacy, both parties have to appear to win. And that's always the problem. Of course, what we need to reach in the next 7 months is a point where both parties appear to have won and can tell their conservative constituencies that they have. It's not going to be easy. John Kerry himself put it, it's going to be tough. But there is more circus than substance here. There is the posturing. There is the macho posturing, which is letting us waste 7 months more when in fact this could be solved right here, right now.
The absent participant in these discussions is obviously Israel, whose views on an Iranian nuclear weapon we're all fairly familiar with. Benjamin Netanyahu has said that no deal is better than a bad deal. Is he right? Is that at least some grounds for optimism?
You know, the Israeli opinion can't be ignored, and the Israeli influence on Washington is awfully obviously significant. So, yeah, of course, in a rhetorical sense, no deal is better than a bad deal. But this muddling along ultimately isn't solving it. And, you know, what you want to do is take the nuclear arms race off the table in the incredibly unstable Middle East.
Because that is the broader picture here, isn't it? That an Iranian nuclear weapon would in due course mean a Saudi bomb.
Right.
It would mean an Emirati bomb, a Bahraini bomb.
And a Qatari bomb.
And a Qatari bomb. And
these are not exactly the most sort of reliable regimes.
That's not going to end well, is it?
No. It's not going to end well, and no sensible thinking person wants that to happen. So you know, and let's be clear, Iran is suffering. They'll tell you that they're enduring the sanctions, but these sanctions are really tough. And if you look at the devaluation of the currency, if you look at the cost of imported consumer hard goods, people are really, this is a big country, you know, it's more than 70 million people. It's not a small little, you know, Gulf state. And people are really feeling it. And you know, there has to be enormous pressure from average people on the street to find a way out of this mess.
Oscar, do you think we're likely to be having this conversation 7 months from now? Or is a deal ever actually going to be done?
I want to be optimistic. We need to be optimistic. We here in the West need to tell Iranians back there that we need this deal. As you yourself just put it, an Iranian bomb is terrible news. An Israeli atomic bomb is already really bad news, and we must remember that. For the other countries in the region to develop their own atomic weaponry would be disastrous. We see what is happening there. And also we need the Iranians come to an agreement which would allow, for wider agreements vis-a-vis Syria and other hotspots.
I'll tell you why I'm not optimistic, because I just think that the bigger problem is Washington, to be honest. I think that there is a very significant constituency of Republicans in Congress who think that giving Obama anything that looks like a victory is not going to, you know, they will stand in the way of anything to avoid giving him that, and some have articulated it that way, and let's face it, Obama has not had a foreign policy victory in 6 years. He hasn't had a lot of victories at all.
Wouldn't it be better if Obama has an agreement and then allows a Republican-led Congress to mess it up? Well, there you can have some political wrangling.
Or perhaps even allows a Republican successor to take some of the credit. I mean, from the Republicans' point of view, is there actual political sense to that, or is it just petulance? Because if Obama does come away 2 years or 1 year from the end of his presidency with some sort of foreign policy triumph, I mean, does it really make a difference?
But you know, you have to walk in their shoes. I think for them it does. But I agree. Can they walk? I don't know. Do dinosaurs walk?
It's the chewing gum at the same time they have trouble with.
Yeah.
Anyway, here in the UK, the Home Secretary, Theresa May, has unveiled a new series of bright ideas for combating terrorism, declaring that the threat is perhaps greater than it has ever been. A new bill will include such powers as forcing terror suspects to relocate, cancelling passports of suspected jihadis at point of departure, banning insurance companies from covering ransoms, and inevitably making it easier for the police to rummage in computers and smartphones. Oscar, I'll ask you first. The greater than ever claim, that's how big the threat is, she says. Is that a bit of a stretch?
Look, the problem with these powers is that on the one hand, of course, there is a threat. Of course, there is a risk. On the other hand, every single public lawyer in this country will tell you that these sorts of measures are have been periodically you know, abused, and the same will happen with these measures. Also, you know, find it very problematic to claim that you know, universities, schools, and shopping malls are you know, must join the war on terror. We in the universities in this country are already having a tough time with the idea that we have to make sure that we have data concerning our foreign students, which we at some point could handle to the hand to the government. The idea that we're going to be able to define extremists and then ban them and then you know, go on and say who can speak and who cannot speak, that can be very problematic.
Is there an argument, Jeffrey? It just vaguely occurs to me. I mean, it's a difficult mindset to get into because I'm not inclined towards violent fanaticism myself. But I just wonder if there is a danger that making, without wishing to belittle the terrible things that have happened, not least in this city, is there a danger that making such a thing of it just kind of encourages people?
Well, I think there's a danger that overreacting to it actually, you know, lets them win. I mean, I think I think there is a sense that after 9/11 in the U.S. that in so many ways the terrorists won because it created this state of fear that continues, and you know, the U.S. has become this kind of fortress, and the erosion of civil rights in the West as a result of 9/11 and 7/7 here. You know, I think there is a consequence of that. So, you know, there are unintended consequences in these things.
Because I'm just struck by the difference in official rhetoric between dealing with Islamist terrorism and dealing with IRA terrorism. I've lived in London long enough to remember that the IRA, despite being a very well-funded and well-organized terrorist organization who twice attempted to assassinate the entire government of the United Kingdom, were usually just spoken of as something of a criminal nuisance.
Yeah, but just to be clear, we're in a different age here. We're in the wired world of the internet, where you know, where young teenagers can go and look at ISIS videos and can be, you know, influenced by them. You know, I'm not sure that would have happened. It's an interesting question whether had the IRA had the internet, whether there would have been a different impact on people. But the reality is it's not in isolation anymore. It's not just a couple of mainstream broadcasters and newspapers filtering news for us, which is what, you know, many of us grew up with. Now you've got this proliferation of media and this access. And you also have, you know, this. I think one of the big concerns here clearly is this disaffected Muslim population of unemployed youth who are drawn to this, some of whom we've talked about before are going to support ISIS. And that's very much a big part of the target of this legislation.
But isn't that the problem? Why are we not talking about unemployment among this young population, and also about Wahhabism, about the fact that this set of ideas came from Saudi Arabia, and therefore we should also take a look at our foreign policy towards those countries? We are not going to solve these problems by solely looking into IP addresses of some young people. Who might or might not be influenced on the internet, and certainly not by suggesting that schools, universities, and shopping malls should engage in some sort of mind police game. That is no good. Is no good for civil liberties. Is no good for freedom. Is no good for what we stand for here. And these measures do run that risk.
I did notice that. The British school authorities are clamping down on both public and private schools here that are Muslim-led, some of which are being accused of fomenting a kind of extremism within their walls, a kind of rhetoric that those of us who obviously don't speak Arabic can't follow. And I think five schools were put on notice just in the last week as a result of this. So the authorities are on one level trying to attack it at its root. But you're right. You know, you don't hear much about the issues of assimilation, of unemployment, and of making people feel at home in this country so that young people don't feel like the country they live in is their enemy.
It is also the case that we in UK universities know how to handle these people. For once, and I speak personally here, I do prefer to be able to debate one of these very wrong preachers rather than allowing him to to spread his hate speech in closed doors. So I would prefer them to be able to talk.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. When we return, we will find out why the United States is shortly going to be recruiting a new defense secretary, and we'll meet the mascots of Rio 2016.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, 22 minutes past the hour. Still with me are Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, within the last couple of hours, flanked by both President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel announced that he was stepping down. There remains some doubt regarding whether he is voluntarily abandoning a sinking ship or being made to walk the plank, but he has been in the Pentagon less than 2 years and appeared to differ with the White House over its Syria strategy to the extremely limited extent that the White House has one. Oscar, I'll ask you first, is this a surprise?
Oh, not at all. not at all. I mean, from the very beginning, from during the hearings in Congress for his confirmation, Joe Hagel was seen as rambling and confused, and I'm afraid that he never managed to clean himself from that stain.
Because the idea was that having him in cabinet was sort of a partisan gesture. Not only was he a combat veteran, a Vietnam veteran, he was also a former Republican senator.
True, but it was also the plan that he would be a sort of defense secretary for peace times. It so happened that reality disagreed.
Yeah, events, dear boy, events, as a wise English politician once said. Is this a big PR problem for Obama, Jeffrey, or are we getting it to the point where it barely matters?
I mean, compared to what? Obama, I'm afraid, got the defense secretary he wanted.
Yeah.
You know, after Gates, he wanted someone who was lower profile, more accommodating to his vision, and he got a kind of mousy guy. I mean, a man who's really, there's a lot to respect in Hagel, to be clear. I don't want to be too harsh on his record, but you know, one of the things about leadership and certainly leadership in America is you've got to be seen to lead, and people have to believe in your vision. And Hagel, as Oscar's already noted, was just incapable of articulating a vision, and he was really brought in to bring down American presence in Afghanistan. He was not brought in to help structure an American plan to obliterate ISIS, and that really is now the American strategic priority.
So do you think Obama, it will be necessary for him to, I guess, pair the announcement of Hagel's replacement, or at least the nomination of Hagel's replacement, with a dramatic rethink re-ISIS?
Oh, absolutely. That needs to be the case. But again, I'm very doubtful there. I'm very skeptical as to what the Obama administration can achieve in the next 2 years. Also because, as it was pointed out before, he is now going to be facing a very hostile Congress. Let us not forget that the next, leader of the Senate Committee for the Armed Forces is going to be Arizona Republican John McCain, you know, as hardline a hawk as you can get. And Obama is being criticized from both sides, from hawks, but also from doves, because the appearance the administration is moving towards war. So, there has to be some definition. Which one? I don't know.
The good news for Obama is that Hagel will stay on until his replacement takes office, which is a good thing because it could take quite a while.
It really, really could. Finally, then, though it's 18 months or something until the Olympic flame is lit in Rio de Janeiro, your first opportunity to purchase Associated Promotional Tat may be as soon as this Christmas. The mascots for the 2016 Olympic and Paralympic Games have been unveiled. The former is a creepy blue-pawed yellow cat, apparently representative of Brazil's fauna, while the latter resembles a radioactive broccoli stem and is sort of apparently a homage to Brazilian plant life. Oscar, why do we do this?
I don't know. Look, I'm a Brazilophile, as you know, and I love what is happening there with the Olympic Games and so on and so forth. But I know it's somebody's job to come up with these sorts of creatures. But why? Why on earth these ones? The first one, the yellow mascot, looks like a cross in between Hello Kitty and Pokemon. It's absolutely terrible. Now, I prefer the flora
broccoli stem.
One. I prefer the broccoli stem. If only because the first European missionaries describe indigenous peoples as being vegetables, as being made of myrtle. So at the very least,
that's a happy historical precedent it's evoking.
It's my very terrible way of trying to save these two.
What I like is that in announcing these two sort of hideous sort of, pieces of plush, as they're called in the trade, they say that they have the agility of cats, the sway of monkeys, and the grace of birds. And I would say, you know, the ability to sell in toy stores fourth component.
I had highlighted that spectacular phrase of marketing drivel in my notes for this item. It's just, I mean, I suppose we have to pause to be slightly grateful that it's none of our jobs to sit around and come up with this but nonsense.
It does speak of what's happened to our world, this kind of commercialization, commodification, Disneyfication of pretty much everything.
Infantilization as well. On which subject, my own favorite Olympic mascot was the non-official one, which was launched in Sydney, my home city, as a kind of rebellion.
When the platypus was actually the official one, I think.
Well, there were several official ones, but this was the 2000 Olympics, which was the usual sort of ghastly, gaudy, commercialized circus, and they did come up with an assortment of ridiculous mascots for people to buy. And a pair of Australian comedians, Roy and H.G., Roy Slaven and H.G. Nelson, launched their own unofficial mascot, Fatso the Fat-Assed Wombat, which outsold by an order of magnitude all the official merchandise. Do either of you have any actual favorite official Olympic mascots?
It speaks of what's happened in the modern times. They actually only began this kind of crazy tradition in 1968 in Grenoble for the Winter Olympics in France.
But although the first one anyone remembers was Misha the Bear from 1980.
Well, if you actually go back, the most charming one was for the 1972 Olympics, which we remember for dark days. But in fact, it was Valdi the Dachshund.
Valdi the Dachshund.
Which, you know what? They just wouldn't do a Dachshund today because I don't think it would sell the way.
Well,
they did.
They did a sort of weird Cubist sheepdog as recently as Barcelona '92. Which I quite liked.
That's my favorite.
I'm glad that you think 1992 is recent. It's good.
Well, I'm relatively more recent than 1972.
I think the Spaniards have a knack for that sort of thing. My other favorite one is the 1982 World Cup mascot, which was a talking orange.
Well, nothing says international football more than
a talking orange.
More than a talking orange. They haven't named these two ghastly items yet. There's going to be a competition. You can choose between the results will be announced on December 14th. You can choose between Oba and Iba, Tibatuke. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. Tibatuke maybe, and Esquindim. I'm not making this up. Or Vinicius and Tom.
The third one, he has to be the
third. Yeah, I mean, Vinicius, they have no choice. I mean, Vinicius and Tom, I mean,
of
really.
Of course.
Yeah.
Vinicius and Tom.
Vinicius de Moraes and Tom Jobim, that's it.
Is that where it's coming from?
I don't think those
foreign tourists will be able to get it.
Is there a Brazilian subtext we're missing here?
Yeah. Anything with three letters will sell.
We will possibly mercifully have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be speaking to our woman in Brussels. We'll meet the curator of the Hayward Gallery's new exhibition here in London. And we'll also be discussing the other latest art openings. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne is here with the headlines.
Talks on Iran's nuclear program will be extended by 7 months after a deadline for a long-term deal passed without success. But all sides involved in the talks in Vienna say there has been significant progress justifying further negotiations. World powers want Iran to agree to curb its uranium enrichment work in return for sanctions relief. The U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is resigning after less than 2 years in the job. The announcement came 3 weeks after the Democrats suffered heavy losses in the U.S. midterm elections. Mr. Hagel is to remain until a successor is in place. There have been reports that President Obama decided to replace him last week. Russia's finance minister says the falling price of oil, together with Western sanctions over the crisis in Ukraine, is costing the country up to $140 billion a year. Anton Sulianov was speaking at a conference in Moscow. And a Swiss museum says it will accept hundreds of works of art bequeathed by the son of Adolf Hitler's art dealer. Cornelius Gerlitt had more than 1,200 works, including paintings by Picasso, Monet and Matisse. He named the Bern Art Museum as the sole inheritor, but the museum has said it won't accept any works thought to have been looted by the Nazis. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Minsk. That's 18:32, actually nearly by the time I finish this time check, 18:33 here in London, which will be 16:33 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. I'm joined now by our Brussels correspondent, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson, who today is on an excursion to Strasbourg. First of all, Charlotte, I understand in Strasbourg tonight there's going to be a no-confidence debate on the European Commission's President Jean-Claude Juncker. What has he done to upset the MEPs?
Well, it actually started about an hour ago. It was actually surprisingly swift. It finished in half an hour, the debate, although we have to wait until Thursday for the results. But yes, Mr. Juncker has annoyed a number of MEPs because of Luxembourg's tax policies when he was Prime Minister from 1995 to 2013. This, of course, all came out earlier this month with the LuxLeaks, when the International Consortium of Journalists published a lot of leaked documents which detailed how around 340 multinationals had paid as little as 1% tax in Luxembourg, with a lot of these policies implemented when he was in charge. So he's been facing questions for a number of weeks over what he knew about these tax deals and whether or not they were, if not legal, whether or not they were moral.
Why has this suddenly become a thing, though? Because Luxembourg's status as a tax haven is not a revelation in itself, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, we've known about this for a while, and certainly at the European level, at the EU level, we've been hearing criticism from the 27 other EU member states about Luxembourg and how they've been slow to sign up to these transparency initiatives. So there's been criticism from Luxembourg for a while, but it really was the full extent, how many companies and how little tax these leaked documents. I mean, they showed the real extent of it. And at this time when Mr. Juncker is pushing for a more fair Europe, and he's really put more transparency at the top of his agenda, so there's claims of hypocrisy. And of course, he's just been in power for just over 3 weeks. So for some MEPs who didn't really want him there in the first place, they've got a stick to beat him with, essentially.
So does this vote act, is it going to have any effect on anything really, or is this just a symbolic hissy fit by a few Eurosceptics?
Well, yeah, I mean that's really the point of it. So it's not a huge amount of MEPs have signed this motion. It's 76, and it is mostly Eurosceptics. It's MEPs from Nigel Farage's UKIP, from Marine Le Pen's from Nationale, from the Five Star Movement in Italy. So these are the sort of elements that the rest of the MEPs don't want to associate with at all. So although a lot of the other MEPs, especially in the Greens, in the left, the Socialist Democrats, they share the concerns about Mr. Juncker and the tax policies, that they're not going to go along with this vote simply because it was tabled by the MEPs that they really don't want to be seen in the same stable. I think he's definitely going to survive, but the questions about the tax issue and whether or not what he knew and when he knew it, they're not going to go away. He's still going to face pressure on those issues.
Now, the European Parliament is, of course, preparing for a visit by Pope Francis tomorrow, and I suppose it'll be a certain relief to all concerned that they won't have to worry about what to do with Ian Paisley on this occasion.
Yes, so there's a lot of excitement at the Parliament, for sure. I mean, I was just there a couple of hours ago, and the flags are waving, there's a stage going up, and it's the first visit by Pope since 1988. And something like 900 journalists have been accredited. So a lot of excitement. Pope Francis obviously has been quite a personality in the past year and a half. So, yeah, everyone's quite looking forward to, I think everyone, a lot of people are looking forward to what he has to say tomorrow. But we do have the voices saying, why is a notionally secular institution inviting a religious figure to address the plenary session? So we do have both sides of the argument being heard in the last couple of weeks.
Okay, well, we shall talk more, I'm sure, about that speech after it has happened. But finally, the EU Parliament is this week, all being well, actually going to pass legislation, which, unlike an awful lot of EU parliamentary legislation, may have a noticeable, measurable effect on everyday lives.
Yes, that's right. They are going to pass today, it's expected, the Environment Committee is going to pass a law which is aimed at phasing out those single-use plastic bags that you get when you go to the local supermarket, the flimsy ones that then often get tossed in the bin. And of course, they don't get tossed in the bin. Well, they do get tossed in the bin, but their life doesn't end there. Apparently, they can last for hundreds and hundreds of years in the environment. They end up in the oceans, causing untold environmental damage. So yes, everybody's been keen to do something about it. And lo and behold, the Member States, the European Parliament and the European Commission have agreed for something, which often is a long, drawn-out process. And this new legislation means that countries have to either start charging for each of these bags, which a lot of countries do already, or they have an option to introduce other measures which will have a verifiable effect. And the idea is to get the average usage down from what it is right now, which is about 191 bags, the average EU citizen uses each year, down to 40 bags by 2025. That's a really drastic reduction. So, yeah, absolutely, this is going to be one of those pieces of legislation which should affect each and every person in the EU.
Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson, tonight in Strasbourg. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be previewing the Heywood Gallery's new End User exhibition here in London.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, our lives have been overrun by the internet so quickly that we've barely noticed it happening. A visitor to our world from as recently as the mid-1990s would be bewildered by the amount of waking time we now spend interacting with screens to the exclusion of most other stimuli. A new exhibition entitled End User, opening later this week at London's Hayward Gallery, considers what the internet has done to us, done for us, and why and how we let that happen. Earlier, I spoke to the show's curator, Dr. Cliff Lawson. First of all, the name of the exhibition, End User, this is what we become whenever we get faced with one of those screeds of gibberish on our computer screen and then just at the end click, yeah, I agree, before, you know, going on to what we wanted to do without quite realising what we've signed up to. Why that name?
One thing I'm thinking about a title for the show, I really love the idea that the end user is, of course, every one of us, whether you're using software or hardware. You know, everybody just, you just click pass, you never read the terms and conditions, but you just want to use the thing that you've either, you know, just downloaded or just bought. But at the same time, the words end user have almost an overhanging feeling, of slightly ominous feeling to them. And I like that idea because it chimes with the artwork that's included in the exhibition that takes a slightly critical look at the internet and the web.
Are there specific aspects it looks at? Because this is something that occurs to me from time to time, because I have the advantage of being so laughably old that I can remember having an adult life before somebody switched the internet on. I'm part of the last generation of people who can actually remember functioning in a world as adult human beings that didn't have the internet, which has overrun our lives to an incredible extent, extraordinarily quickly. What kind of things were you looking for in terms of what the artists were focusing on?
I think generally, you're absolutely right, and there's thousands of artworks out there that engage the internet in some way. And in terms of picking work for the show, I really wanted to focus on artists and artwork who asked us to slow down a little bit. You're right, the internet's moving at the speed of light, like quite literally in terms of like fiber optics. But these artworks ask you to slow down a little bit, to sort of take stock of where things are and ask questions about, you know, how you're getting information, where that information is coming from, where the information that you give to the internet is going and how it's used, and sometimes, I might say in inverted commas, abused.
Because that's the thing we've lost, isn't it? It is the pause for reflection. It just occurs to me occasionally, on social media especially, that the internet is basically a vast contraption for driving people completely crazy. The people get into this thing of reacting rather than thinking. They sort of think, somebody's gone to the trouble to make a JPEG of this. It must be true, and therefore just forwarding it. I want to talk a bit about some of the specific exhibits, in particular because, like every internet user, I have probably spent far too much of my life looking at amusing footage of cats. You have a piece by Corey Archangel, which has basically confronted and enshrined that phenomenon.
Indeed. And that's a piece that's called Dry Klaverstück, Opus 11. Excuse my pronunciation.
I left that for you to pronounce.
Do you
see what I did there?
Right into that one, yeah. It's a work that Corey made. It's his supercut, basically. He went onto YouTube and brought together hundreds of images of cats playing the piano, basically singling out all the notes from those clips as the cats prance across the keys, to put them together to play that piece by Arnold Schoenberg, which is an early piece of atonal music in avant-garde music history. And he's basically bringing those two things into collision, where on the one hand, you've got the sort of ubiquitous sort of clickbait YouTube video, and then on the other hand, you've got this sort of atonal, verging on unpleasant to listen to piece of music, and put them together. And so the piece you watch in the gallery is these cats almost fumbling their way through playing the composition.
That piece, though, sounds almost like a celebration of internet culture, because it's something that wouldn't have been possible previously. And it is one of the things, again, I can remember life before it, but it's one of the things I like about the internet. It's that it has given a forum for smart, witty, creative people who beforehand would have had nowhere they could take this. If you were previously, say even 20 years ago, minded to create a collage of cats playing Schoenberg, there wouldn't have been many places you could take it. It would have been very hard to source the original footage. But some of the pieces in the exhibition are criticisms, I guess, of online culture. Particularly, I wanted to ask about Liz Sterry's piece, which involved her collecting everything she could find about herself.
Well, Liz Sterry is about a blogger. Everything that she could find out about a blogger. She looked up this blogger who lives in Canada and brought together everything that she could find together about her on social media channels and through the blogger's website. You know, everything that she was revealing about herself, and put that together and recreated her bedroom, a sort of personal, intimate space. And you look into this installation, which is it's a bit creepy in that sense. There's a huge amount of voyeurism involved, but of course it's absolutely pointing to the amount of information that we're sort of freely put up on the internet.
It is extraordinary, though, given the opportunity, what people will broadcast. The Kay's blog piece in particular, what effect do you think it's likely to have, or what effect do you you hope it will have on people who might look at it?
I think people, when they see it, sort of have a bit of a shiver, and it is, because it is a slightly creepy installation to recreate somebody's bedroom. But of course, that is the view that is out there on the internet when you're looking through her webcam past her face into her personal space. And I think that sort of that jarring effect that one gets when you look at this and other works in the exhibition just makes you pause and again take stock, think a little bit more carefully about the sort of the vast phenomenon that surrounds us.
And that's clearly the subtext, or at least the idea behind a piece like John Ruffman's Nine Eyes as well. And again, it's as you're mentioning, it's not dissimilar to the familiar clickbait thing, that kind of look at that weird thing that's just turned up on Google Street View. I have a particular soft spot for the people who know the Google Street car is coming and therefore sort of dress up in funny costumes or sort of stage bizarre tableau in the street. But he's gone a bit further than that. Again, he's assembled a piece.
Yeah, John, since 2009, has been archiving images that the Street View cars have been taking. When this sort of project started out, I suppose there was a bit of a window whereby these cars are snapping hundreds and thousands of photos as they move around the world, and all that data is being sort of set and then uploaded. And there might be a window where there's bizarre things happening on the streets that John's been able to find and capture, and you know, save an archive for us to look at before, say, the world is sort of tidied up a little bit, maybe even sterilized into the street view that you know you use to find the address.
Just finally, then, remind our listeners where and until when they can see this exhibition.
Yeah, people can see End User in the Hayward Gallery project space. The exhibition opens on November the 27th and runs until the 8th of February.
And free of charge, we should mention.
It is free of charge, and it's at the South Bank Centre this weekend, the end of November. It's worth noting that the exhibition is part of the Web We Want Festival that looks at all these issues that we've been discussing. People can come and see some other installations and participate in some workshops as well.
That was the Hayward Gallery's Cliff Lawson speaking to me earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for some music on Midori House. Before we check in on other new exhibitions in London, here's some new music by French artist Owl. That's Owlle. This is Don't Lose It.
We rise, we fall, we weep, but when love's walking down my street, I know. Just forget my war and whisper to you through the door. Oh, 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 keep me, that's all. But I tell you, don't want to lose it. I tell you, don't want to prove it. Let's start with zero. We'll be right back.
With Don't Lose It. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for the end of the show at 18:52, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today in the studio to discuss actual art openings in actual galleries, we have the art critic Fison Gunner, editor of the website artsdesk.com. First of all, you wanted to talk about the reopening. It is one of the most spectacular art spaces in London, if not the world. This is the cast court at the V&A.
Absolutely.
Which I was actually in a few weeks ago.
And what did you think of it?
Well, I was mostly chasing a friend's 2-year-old around it.
Right,
and
okay.
We were trying, obviously, to overawe him with these fantastic, immense replicas of the greatest of sort of Western sculptural art. Nothing in the V&A excited him as much as those just Perspex boxes you can drop change in.
Well, there are two cast courts, and only one of them has been refurbished.
We may have been in the non-refurbished one.
Yeah,
that was probably the problem.
Still as it is. Anyone who's remembered the cast courts prior to this spectacular reopening, which is taking place on Wednesday, will remember them with great affection as a kind of higgledy-piggledy Aladdin's cave. I mean, it's a big gallery, high ceilings, and it's got plaster casts of great works of Renaissance art. So the particular cast gallery that I'm talking about is the Italian Gallery. It's now renamed the Western Cast Court after its benefactor. And it's got such treasures as Michelangelo's David and sculpture by Michelangelo. So it was opened, it was originally opened in 1873. And the collection is kind of unique because the collection's never changed. In the 19th century, plaster casts of great works of art were very popular because people often couldn't go and look at the work, look at the originals. So they would go to what was then called the South Kensington Museum, it's now the V&A, and look at these spectacular life-scale casts of the originals. So it's pretty spectacular space.
What difference has this refurbishment made? What have they actually done to the pieces?
Well, anyone who remembers it originally, as I do, it was very, not originally, I mean, that was 19th century, but remembers it before it closed about 2 years ago. It was kind of slightly chaotic. I mean, I kind of liked it like that. It was a chaotic space, all higgledy-piggledy, you know, as if it was a secret treasure trove. And now it's kind of better organized. It kind of makes more sense in terms of, you know, works that are, I mean, there's a corner where the Michelangelos are shown, and you've got three sculptures, including, you know, the huge and impressive David. You know, so they're all in one part of the gallery. And then you've got other casts, such as the cast of the pulpit from Pisa Cathedral. So that's huge. So it's got these really monumental casts of bits of cathedrals and funeral effigies and just these remarkable things. It's a treasure trove of the greatest in Italian architecture and sculpture.
Okay, well, that's the new look Western Cast Court at the V&A. Also wanted to ask about, I know you wanted to talk about, this exhibition looks fantastic. It's a new photo exhibition at Tate Modern. We're obviously not struggling at the moment for exhibitions and events rooted in the fact that it's the centenary of the beginning of the First World War. But this one looks actually really quite special because it's a history of conflict photography, which more or less kind of started in that conflict.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it goes
sort
even
of.
Further back.
There's been a few, but that was the war in which we first became used to wide scale footage of conflict.
Absolutely, but it remarkably it does go further back. It goes way back to the Crimean War with Roger Fenton's photographs of the aftermath of the Crimean War, and this exhibition, it is about conflict, but it takes an unusual approach because it's looking at photographs which are taken in the aftermath of particular conflicts. So the organising principle is that you've got one room where you have photographs of the aftermath of conflicts which have taken place, which have been taken immediately after the conflict took place. And then a second gallery where there were kind of days after the conflict took place. And so it continues. And the last gallery focuses on photographs which are taken of the site of conflict, you know, decades after the event. So it's really thinking about how conflict has impacted upon that space, what traces it's left behind. It's an unusual way to approach war photography. I mean, you've got, one of the better known war photographers, British war photographers, is Don McCullin. And you've got, for instance, his photograph, very powerful photograph of a US Vietnam soldier. It was taken in 1968, and he just looks, he doesn't even look at the camera, he's completely shell-shocked, his eyes are glazed over. So that's taken moments after a particular, or days, I think, after a particular conflict. So it's really looking at it that way.
On that 1,000-yard stare, we will have to leave it there. Fisa and Gunnar, thank you very much for joining us. That's Conflict Time Photography at the Tate Modern. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie and researched by David Pleasant, Benoit Grogan-Avignon and Jonathan Bartlett. Our studio managers were Chad Chilvers and Antonio Fernandez. Up after the headlines, Rob Bound has the culture show. I'll be back with The Daily with Emma Nelson at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 tomorrow at London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks very much for listening.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.